Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Hello and good evening. Thank you very much for joining us here on Interchange for January 17th. I'm your host, Ryan Dawes. I'm joined here in the Firehouse Studios with program specialist for the City of Bloomington Parks and Rec Department, Michael Simmons. Later in the show, we'll be hopefully joined by Sarah Laughlin, the MCPL Library Director, as well as Bloomington High School North Librarian Kathy Lozier. First, let's get started discussing One Book, One Bloomington with Michael Simmons. Michael, thank you very much for joining us here on Interchange.
My pleasure.
Excellent. So we're here to talk about One Book, One Bloomington. Talk about this year's book selection, and which we'll announce later on in the show. But first, let's start by explaining what is One Book, One Bloomington, and what roles does the city have, what roles does the library have, as well as the local high schools. What roles do they have in this nine-year-old project, One Book, One Bloomington?
We actually call it One Book, One Bloomington and Beyond now because we became aware that other communities in South Central Indiana were also choosing this book and discussing it as communities. So OBOB for short. This program got started with the Bloomington Area Arts Council. Sally Gaskell came to Bloomington as the executive director of that organization, and she had experience from Rochester, New York, where they had done a community read similar to this and thought that it would be a nice fit for Bloomington. So she proposed that the Arts Council sponsor the activity, and at that time I was serving on the Board of Trustees, and I was assigned the job of getting it going. So we began then and continued with the Arts Council for some time and then gradually began to add other community partners. And now it's expanded. And of course, the Bloomington Area Arts Council no longer exists, but the program continues with the sponsorship of the City of Bloomington Parks and Recreation Department, the Monroe County Public Library, the Monroe County Community Schools Libraries, the Indiana University Libraries. So we've been very fortunate in having these very active community partners who were able to keep the program going.
Now, when we talk about geographically, what is the reach of OBOB or One Book, One Bloomington? Is it South Central Indiana? Is it Monroe County? You said Bloomington and beyond. So what is beyond geographically? You mentioned the entities, but you know, how far have you heard people reading these book selections? You know, does it span the US or is it pretty locally focused?
Well, our purpose, of course, is locally focused, and we included the beyond because we wanted to include Ellettsville and other communities in our area. But actually, it does have a national impact because we have a web presence through the Monroe County Public Library, a page that is devoted to One Book, One Bloomington. And so we found that people in other communities are looking at our selections and then choosing those for their community reads. So we do have an influence that goes far beyond Indiana.
Now, tell me a little bit about the selection process. Now, we have a community read that is where, as I understand, a group picks one book to read and everybody reads it. Talk a little bit about how these books are selected.
Initially, when we began the program, our idea was to have the community go through a nomination process in which we had ballot boxes out and people would suggest books that would be appropriate for the One Book, One Bloomington project. And then later on, we would have an election in which the book would be chosen from the nominees. We've simplified that process a little bit in the last few years in that rather than asking people to go through those two processes, we have convened a group of community members as a reading advisory group who make recommendations to us about the books that would be appropriate, and then we have an election in which all community members can participate to vote for the book out of a nominating list of between 5 and 8 books each year.
Now, the whole purpose of this is to promote a specific type of reading. You called it, as we were speaking before,
the show today. You call it literary reading. What is literary reading, and how is it different from other types of reading?
Well, a lot of people do a lot of reading in the course of their jobs, of course, reading manuals, memos, emails, and all of those sorts of things. But what we wanted to concentrate on was the art of literary reading. In other words, engaging with literary works of art and getting into a dialogue with the authors of those works, and also thinking about how the works are applicable to our own lives and how they reflect situations that may exist in our community. So when we began the project, we decided that we would focus on fictional works because we thought that that gave a greater range to people's imaginations in discussing problems and issues that were raised by the author. So we have continued with that process. We had one book that was classified as a work of creative nonfiction, Reading Lolita in Tehran. But other than that, we have concentrated on works of fiction and tried to encourage people to read these works, not only for the artistic merit of the works themselves, but also for the social issues that are raised in the course of reading a book like this.
Now, in past discussions, as people unite over the one book that was selected each year since 2002, what sort of social issues are raised by these books? In other words, what are some common threads that people observe and, you know, find striking here in Monroe County?
Well, there are a lot of issues that have been raised by different books that we've discussed over the years. Our very first book, A Lesson Before Dying by Ernest Gaines, had a lot of really meaty issues in it that really provoked very thoughtful discussion in the community. Among those were the capital punishment, race relations, and a number of other issues that people really found helped them to see our own community in a different light and think about some of the problems and issues that exist here that were portrayed in the book in some way. So each year we try to select a work that has not only literary merit but also raises significant social issues about life in community.
Now I will talk about more specific meetings and public discussions for these books later on in the show, but you know, what form have past public discussions around each year's book taken? Are we meeting at the library? Are we meeting in schools? And what groups are meeting to talk about this one book?
Yeah, that's a good question. When we formulated the project, we wanted to involve as many people as possible. So the criteria for the selection of the book would be that it would be a work of fiction, that it would be available in paperback, that it would be accessible for students from middle school and up, that it would have significant social issues, and that it would have artistic merit, of course. We give people an opportunity to engage on a number of different levels. There are publicly sponsored One Book, One Bloomington book discussions that take place, and we'll talk about some of those opportunities a little bit later. But also, we encourage people to create their own book discussions, and those can be either in the formal book group, a private group, a group hosted by a faith community, or it can be as simple as a family deciding to read the book together and to talk about it over the dinner table. The idea is to get people engaged with the book and talking about it with friends and neighbors and family members, and the context in which that happens is not as important as the fact that it does happen. So we hope to get as many people in the community reading the book as possible and discussing it as widely as possible. One of the things that we did not expect is that a number of private groups that are not affiliated with the One Book, One Bloomington project select the One Book, One Bloomington selection for one of the readings that their group will do. And I think that's a way to really expand the outreach of this program a lot, because we're not, as a committee, are no longer responsible for creating all of the public events, but they sort of take on a life of their own.
Now, how successful have these DIY independent book groups been? Do they meet the entire year? Do they meet as long as it takes the last person to finish the book? And also talk a little bit about maybe one or two specific DIY groups that you have heard of that, you know, really engage with that year's selection?
Well, some of these, some of the groups are ongoing groups themselves, so that they would be discussing a number of books throughout the course of the year, but for one of their meetings, they would discuss the One Book, One Bloomington selection. And some of the groups have actually have come up with a strategy that I hadn't thought of, which is they select the One Book, One Bloomington book for their first book of the year following our One Book, One Bloomington read, because then they have the availability of a lot of copies of the book in the community and don't have to fight to find a copy. But there are a number of church groups that have done this, and also a number of just groups of friends who have gotten together and talked about it.
Are you a part of any of these groups?
I lead an ongoing book discussion group, Ex Libris, which meets at the Barnes & Noble booksellers and once a month. And we discuss a wide variety of contemporary literature throughout the year, but we always reserve our February meeting for the One Book, One Bloomington discussion. So it's sort of a tradition.
And so do you think book groups are more or less popular than they used to be? There's some statistics, which I'll talk about later, about how literary reading is, in general, on the decline. In these book groups, I have several friends who are in book groups. Talk about, you know, if somebody's has never been in a book group, what do you do? What do you talk about? I guess it comes with responsibilities. What might that include?
The book groups are structured in various ways, and some of them are quite formal, with an assigned leader for the discussion and a very businesslike approach to discussing literature. Others are more social occasions where people come together and discuss a book, but incidentally talk about other things in their lives and have refreshments and meet in someone's home. So a very more of an informal atmosphere. I think there's a place for all of those because it encourages people to read. You're correct that literary reading is in decline across all age groups and all ethnic groups in the United States at the present. One of the things that I am wondering about is what the effect of the e-books will be on reading and whether that will increase it. I've noticed that within our book group, Ex Libris, that we began with no one having an electronic reader, and now I think I'm one of the few who doesn't. And people talk about how easy it is to get hold of the books, and so they don't have to go through a process of either seeking them out in a store, ordering them online, or trying to obtain them from a wait list at the library. So I'm hopeful that that might be a way that people will feel that literature is more accessible to them.
So what do you think about switching from print and paper to a download and a screen? How does that change the way in which somebody engages with a book?
I'm not sure. Of course, since I'm not a user of that format, I can't speak with authority, but I personally like the feel of a book in my hand. But I know that from talking to members of our group who have used these, that they find them to be very useful, very portable. And they are learning all of the features so that they're able to take notes and cross-reference things in the book by going onto the internet. So I think for people who are tech savvy, it's really changing the way that they read, but encouraging them to read more.
Now, as we mentioned, literary reading in general is on a decline, according to a study done by the National Endowment for the Arts. In 2004, literary reading, what we're talking about now, has dropped an average of 10% from the mid-80s to 2004. Among the youngest demographics, it has dropped by nearly 30%. As of 2004, less than half of all U.S. American adults engaged in literary reading. Now, tell me a little bit about why you think, in your experience, when you observe people in your book group, I'm sure those numbers fluctuate. You know, why do you think this has declined since the 80s?
Well, I think there are a lot of things that are demanding people's attention. There are many other media that they're able to engage with, so that reading does not have the same place in American life that it did perhaps earlier on. I think that people will come back to books. I think that's something that happens in perhaps in a cyclic way. But I do think that the availability of a large number of electronic media have maybe drawn people away from the book.
I see. And do you think that is especially true for a younger demographic? As I said, 30% of the youngest demographics have dropped since the mid-80s, which is a larger percentage than the overall national drop.
I would say that's probably true, although then we look at phenomena like Harry Potter, which really has engaged not only younger people, but
all adults
as well. So I think, you know, if something catches fire with a young reader, it's highly possible that the younger people will still engage with the books.
So I'm here with program specialist with the City of Bloomington Parks and Rec Department, Michael Simmons. We're talking about One Book, One Bloomington. Later on in the show, we'll talk a little bit about youth and reading, as well as this year's nominees for this year's selection. Thank you for joining us here on Interchange. We'll be back here after a short break. And we're back. Thank you for joining us here on Interchange. I'm your host, Ryan Dawes. I've been speaking with program specialist with the City of Bloomington Parks and Rec Department, Michael Simmons. And just joining us here in the studios is Monroe County Public Library Director, Sarah Laughlin. Thank you very much for joining us, Sarah.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Glad you're here. So as we were talking about earlier in the last segment about the overall decline in literary reading. Now, what I want to know from you two is, as we encourage literary reading locally, what kind of people do literary readers become? You know, how I'm going to operate under the, and confidently so, I'm going to operate under the presumption that reading makes one a better person. So how does that change? And, you know, from we have a county library perspective as well as a city perspective, why is it in your respective interests to encourage reading and talk a little bit about, as I mentioned, what kind of people literary readers become? Either one of you can address this.
Go ahead, Sarah.
Well, I guess I would, I don't think we've actually seen a decline in reading in our community, so I might argue with that point a little bit. I just am working on the annual report for the library for 2011, and our circulation is up 4.5%, and I believe that's about the 15th year in a row that we've set a new record. So we see people continuing to use the library. Now, reading is changing format, I would say, but we're interested in reading wherever and however it occurs. So whether it's on a Kindle or in print or in a magazine or in the newspaper or on the back of a cereal box, we're okay with it. But yes, I agree with you that reading, it's a sign of an educated person and a thoughtful person, I think. And so it's a way of taking in new information and considering points of view or experiencing worlds or emotions that you otherwise would not be able to. So certainly that expands your mind in the course of that. There's fairly new research too about vocabulary, and you might think that children learn to read in, you know, first grade or second grade, and that they just coast after that. But the research shows that vocabulary is an unconfined skill. So it continues throughout your life. And certainly reading is probably
unconfined, meaning it continues to develop.
It's not confined to a certain point of, you know, development. It's unconstrained, and it continues to develop throughout your life. That is, if you put new words in front of yourself. And so that's certainly much easier if you're reading.
Now, Michael, talk a little bit about why do you think it's in, for example, you work for the city, why is it in the city's best interest to encourage this type of literary reading?
Well, I would second everything that Sarah said, but also I think that reading is a way to broaden one's experience of the world, and I think that in itself makes one a better citizen, a more informed citizen, someone who is able to participate knowledgeably in the democratic processes that form the basis of our government. So I think it's really important for people to have a very broad experience, broader than the experience they would have if they were just staying in their own community, and reading is a way to do that. But also, lifelong learning is one of my real projects, and not only for me, but I like to encourage other people to engage in lifelong learning. I administer People's University, which is our adult leisure education program, and I see the effects of learning on people, how it really makes their life more enjoyable and fulfilling, and I think that reading also helps with that, with making one a lifelong learner.
Now, with all of our instant access to information, it seems like we can very easily become well-read or well-versed in a certain genre of movie, and we can even get very obscure in what we, especially with access to internet and so forth, and the library, you have a whole plethora of information there. It seems that it might be kind of hard to find one thing that people can unite over. I mean, I remember talking within my own personal social network about movies I've seen or music that I'm into, and my other friends are saying, you know, I don't know what you're talking about. No, I've never heard of that. And then I have the same response to things that they're excited about, simply because, you know, we haven't heard of it, and there's a certain amount of obscurity. And while it is cool to find out about things that are seemingly unknown or untouched, we lose that ability to engage over a certain thing. And whereas if we find one book or one movie, we can engage, you know, hours and hours and hours, rather than saying, oh, I haven't seen that one before, or oh, I haven't read that one before, and then the conversation ends. So what do you two think about having just one book? I mean, we're talking about encouraging reading all across the board, but why just one book?
Well, I will say I've been involved in choosing a book for a number of different projects recently, and it is very tough because reading a book is on the one hand a very personal experience, and it's very difficult to choose unless everyone in the group has read all of the books and can make some sort of a judgment. But the process of that is really fun, because it becomes a book discussion in and of itself. So it's not unlike sharing a movie with, you know, talking about movies or your favorite music, and in that you learn a lot about the person, the people at the table who are talking about it. I think what we're looking for in the one book, and I have to say I've never participated in the selection of the short list, but is a book that has rich texture of meaning, is fabulously well written, and offers some kind of commentary or window into something that we're in, you know, something that's going on in our world that we're interested in, and so there's many possibilities to pick from, and the picking itself is got to be the most fun.
I think Sarah just volunteered for our reading advisory group for next year. That's wonderful.
Well, it seems like that could, you know, easily become a very passionate discussion. You know, what could strike somebody more than a book or a movie or a film or a song? You know, in books in particular, you really connect with because you spend a lot of time engaging with it. So I can imagine there's some almost maybe even heated debates as to what gets selected and people advocating or, you know, antagonizing against a certain selection based upon a certain feeling they have. Mm-hmm.
You know, but to get back to your point of the engaging around one book, I'm reminded of my college, my undergraduate education at Southern Methodist University in the 60s. We had an integrated curriculum in which selecting a range of books in which everyone would read was very important. And the purpose behind that was so that we could sit down in the student union and talk to each other about books that we all had read in common. And I think that's one of the really important things about the One Book Project, is that it does provide a commonality, a way, a point of connection between people in the community, so that they can focus a discussion on a particular piece of writing, and that will then inspire conversations. And those conversations are the really important thing in this project.
Now, do you two think that this perhaps is maybe why, you know, I feel like I had a certain required reading in high school. You know, it seems like it's always either Grapes of Wrath, 1984, Orwell, Steinbeck, Mark Twain. Do you think this is a similar reason as to why these, you know, come up generation after generation? I mean, millions and millions of books have come out since these books were written, so, you know, why do we keep revisiting? Do you think it's the same reason, so that we can all, you know, have this common ground as U.S. Americans?
Well, that's probably part of it, but I think there are books that just have staying power. You know, the really great books have lives of their own. They continue beyond their original publication, And it's because they speak to a deeper emotional or intellectual or both concern that crosses time, you know, a specific time period.
Well, now that you mentioned that staying power, I want to talk a little bit about past book selections for One Book, One Bloomington and beyond. We have a huge, huge array. We have books that are set here in the U.S. We have books that are set several throughout the Middle East, several modern ones, as well as some classics like The Great Gatsby, Fahrenheit 451, 1984 by Orwell. So talk a little bit, what are some of your favorites of the past 9 years?
Go ahead, Michael. I wasn't around that long.
Interestingly enough, I think some of our best discussions have been centered around some of the dystopian novels. The 1984 comes to mind, and Fahrenheit 451. I think those really spurred a great deal of discussion on the part of people who were participating in the One Book, One Bloomington project. Although we did get comments from people who said, you know, you really pick a lot of really downer books. But I think the people who engaged in those discussions really found a deep level of meaning in those works. So those come to mind as things that were really sparked some of the most intense and thought-provoking discussions.
Now, with books like 1984, how do you think our community can engage with that? How did you observe people engaging with both the modern ones as well as some of these classics?
Well, we have read some classics. We read Great Gatsby, and of course, Fahrenheit 451 is a classic in itself. But I think that people tended to relate it to things that were happening in our community. We talked about issues related to censorship. We talked about issues related to the loss of meaning and how we have to try to retrieve that or recreate meaning in our lives. So I think throughout, people engaged with elements of those books that had meaning for them, and the reason they had meaning was because they could connect them with things in their daily lives that were important to them.
Great, excellent. So we have... Let's talk about this year's nominations before we get to this year's selections. We'll address that in the next segment. But let's talk a little bit about this year's nominations and, you know, what sort of feedback did you get about this particular list? Have you read any of the books that were nominated?
You know, this was an off year for me. In the past, I have gotten my hands on all five of them the minute the list came out, and really enjoyed all five and found that it was a dead tie for first in most cases. This year, I was struggling to find the time to do that. So I haven't read all of them. So I'm probably going to have to defer to Michael, who I'm sure has.
Oh, I wish I had. But actually, I have not read all of them either. Again, these were books that were recommended by our Reading Advisory Committee, and there were people on the committee who had read all of these books, and they were able to, by discussion with their fellow committee members, convince everyone that these were books that were worthy of including on the nominating list. But I have certainly not read all of them, although I know something about all of them.
I see. Now, remind me about how these were voted on. I saw that there is a way in which that these are selected by local citizens. You propose the nominee list, and then local citizens have the power to choose the book. How does that voting process work?
We have ballot boxes that... Margaret Harder from the Monroe County Public Library puts together for us each year, and we distribute those throughout the community in bookstores, libraries, and other locations, government buildings, so that people have access to them. The ballots have the names of all of the books on them, and people can fill out a paper ballot and drop it in the box. We then collect those and count them as a committee. People also have the opportunity to vote online at the library website. So we have several ways for people to engage in the voting process, and that's one thing that we're really proud of, is that in our community it is the community that chooses the book. In many other communities, the committee will choose a book that they then announce to the community that will be the book to read, but I think it's really important that we have this democratic process going on in the book selection.
I see. Now, before we announce that book, which I'm excited to say that this will be the medium by which this year's book is announced. Michael, we were talking about how we're shifting from print reading to also including ways of reading through a Kindle, an iPad, on a computer. Sarah, what do you observe at the library? Not only what types of vehicles we're using to read, but also what is popular right now? What are people most driven to read right now?
You know, our community is such an amazing community. We have people reading all kinds of different things. I will say today we had downloadable days, the first downloadable day at the library where you could drop in and with your new e-reader, whatever it is, and we would help you figure out how to use it. And we were absolutely swamped, I understand. And there were people who hadn't taken it out of the box, who hadn't charged it up yet, and, you know, absolute beginners. And then there were people interested in what could they download through the library, and they, you know, and more advanced e-reader assistance. We have a very large group of fiction readers. Mysteries are probably the largest percentage of books that we have a holds list for, people waiting for a particular mystery. So that's our...
And is that your best indicator for what is hot?
I think so. And that would probably be true in any library across the country. So we're no exception there. But what we also have is a very large nonfiction readership, people who are reading biographies, people who read the New York Times book review every Sunday and get on the website and put things on hold. Sunday is our biggest day to put things on hold. We always have a huge new batch. We actually collect about 1,200 holds a day on behalf of our customers. So it's a very large and active group. But there are also people reading their way through historical fiction or science fiction. We can't get enough graphic novels and manga for people who are into that more visual medium.
Being that One Book, One Bloomington is also considering middle school and high schoolers, what do you observe our younger teenagers reading most often at the library?
Well, they're the ones that really love the graphic novels and manga at this point. But also, Harry Potter has brought a whole bunch of kids into that kind of witches and wizards world and the Twilight series. Again, brought a whole group of kids back, and the I'm trying to think of the name of the other one. It'll come back to me. But those big blockbuster titles have big impact in the same way I think that a good book does at any age. There's buzz, you know, people talking to other people about, have you read it, and that brings in more people. So they're also busy reading stuff for school and other things. Magazines are a huge favorite among teenagers, you know, because that you can focus on the topic you're interested in, whether that's...
Certainly. Well, I'm here in the studios with Monroe County Public Library Director Sarah Laughlin and Programming Specialist for the City of Bloomington, Michael Simmons. Here on Interchange, talking about One Book, One Bloomington. Coming up here and after a short break, we'll announce this year's selection for One Book, One Bloomington and beyond. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WFHB comes from Taste of India, a locally owned and operated restaurant featuring a lunch buffet open 7 days a week, with a variety of vegan and vegetarian options. Taste of India is located at 316 East 4th Street, next to the fire station. Dine in or call ahead for takeout or home delivery. 3 3 3 1 3 9 9. Back.
I have in the studios with me Sarah Laughlin, Director of the Monroe County Public Library and Programming Specialist for the City of Bloomington, Michael Simmons. Thank you both for being with us tonight to talk about One Book, One Bloomington and beyond. So let's get to it. Let's talk about what is this year's book selection I'll let you're carrying the book, Sarah, so I'll let you reveal it to the public.
Drum roll.
And I said to Michael, I don't have to put it in my purse on the way out. I can just wave it around. Now I've been so worried somebody would pick up on what I was reading. The 2012 One Book, One Bloomington and Beyond winner is Room by Emma Donahue, published in 2010 by Little Brown.
Now, tell us a little bit about this book. How do you think it fits into One Book, One Bloomington and Beyond's, you know, objective in uniting a community around one book? And what sort of issues do you think it'll raise?
Well, let me tell you about the story first, and then we'll get into what it means, because it's a very unusual book, I think, and a bold effort by a writer. The story is told from the viewpoint of Jack, who has just turned 5. In the first chapter, and his ma. So that's not so unusual. And it begins with him describing the daily routine in Room. Notice there's no the room. And it includes many things that all children love. I think any parent will recognize what's going on. They're reading books together. They're playing language games. They're measuring things. They're running and jumping and yelling and fixing and eating meals, very much looking forward to eating meals, watching a little bit of TV, would like to watch more, but mom won't let him, making toys, you know, playing games, getting ready for bed. And then there are the nightly visits by old Nick, who is, for Jack, a mysterious stranger. He's never really laid eyes on him. He hears his voice. And that is because during the time that Jack is there, during the time that old Nick is there, Jack stays in wardrobe. Well, gradually, what you become aware of as the reader is that Jack and his ma are captives in an 11 by 11 foot former tool shed that old Nick has reinforced to keep them from getting out. And it's obvious that Ma is hiding something, but it's nearly halfway through the book when she tells Jack that she was 19 when he stole me. So he captured her on the way to class as a freshman at a university. And she's been there 7 years. Jack is 5. The story changes gears then after old Nick gets really angry and turns off the electricity for a few days when one of Jack's toys inadvertently falls on him during one night. And then he reveals that he's been laid off for 6 months, and Ma begins to worry that his home will be foreclosed and he'll leave and abandon them locked in this shed. And so there's all of a sudden extreme urgency to take action. Plus, I think Jack is getting bigger and she's not going to be able to fit him in the wardrobe much longer, and he's getting smarter and beginning to ask questions. So Jack is a pretty normal kid by all measures when you're reading the book, and Ma seems like a pretty normal mother. I mean, she's resilient, she's resourceful, she's loving, both in her captivity and later in reentry, but we do begin to understand. And I went back and read the first chapter again yesterday. I was looking for a quote where I could share some of the language with you, and realize it's even in the first chapter the enormous strain that she's under is there, and you aren't quite aware of it when you're first reading it. So it is. At the heart, a story of a mother and a child's relationship in isolation from the world. And it's kind of idealistic in that regard. There's nobody else. There's no worries. The child is very innocent. It's a world of innocence and splendor. And as one reviewer called it, deep wonderment. And the invented language that Jack uses is one of the reasons why I think it must have been just incredibly difficult to write the story, because she has invented a particular language for him. And the reason the book is called Just Room is there's only one of everything in this room. There's one bed, there's one robe. So you don't need an adjective in front of that. You just need the word. But it's still believable in a kind of childlike, funny, peculiar way that children refer to things when they're comfortable and at home. So that seems very normal to me, and it's contrasted against a very disturbed world. And even in the reentry, when she has to explain to Jack the dangers and difficulties and differences, it's not easy for a child to make sense of that. And so you come to that afresh with a child's perspective. And I really loved that part of the book. The author, Emma Donoghue, is Irish and openly gay, but she lives in Canada with her partner and her two children now. And she, in an interview that I read, said that the story came to her in a flash after she heard about a 24-year-old Austrian woman whose father had imprisoned her and fathered six children on his own daughter. And she apparently heard that story in the car driving down the road, and this, I think, the situation occurred to her as a good setting to explore the mother-child relationship. She was actually criticized by some reviewers who thought she had taken advantage of the J.C. Duggard captivity, but the book was actually at the publisher by the time that happened. So it is independent of that. And it really is. One of the things that the character in the book does when she does escape is researches slavery and captivity, and makes the case that she's not the only one, she's not the first one, she's certainly not the only one nowadays who's enslaved or kept in captivity, and tries to make that.
Does that in some way allay some of her concerns that, you know, she knowing that while she is in physical isolation, she's not alone in what she is experiencing?
I don't think she's thinking about that when she's in captivity, but this is after there's quite a dramatic escape, and so I won't say too much about that, because that's the second half of the book, what the escape and what happens after that. But I don't want to give away the ending. But
so we have a lot of issues at play here. As you know, the most relatable one will probably be that the relationship between a son or daughter and their mother or father. What are some issues do you think this can raise, and what are ways in which you related to it?
One of the things that I think you as the reader become more aware of as the book rolls on is that because Jack has been with his mother every single moment of his life in this little tiny enclosed space, he hasn't made probably the separation that children make, when they are away from the mother. That most children would have made, certainly by the age of five. So he is very, very uncomfortable being away from her at all. But she, on the other hand, is very, although she's extremely dedicated to her child, is also, looking forward to re-entering the world and to seeing her friends and to reuniting with her family. And she begins to introduce that to him as part of the escape planning. But it's just a fairy tale to him. He is not aware that there is a world out there beyond this room. So there is kind of a difference between the child not wanting the separation and the parent wanting and wanting it, and in the short term, and I think in the long term, understanding that it's essential for a child to grow up.
Now, do you think that this maybe has some of the staying power that some of the other past One Book, One Bloomington and Beyond selections have had? And also, what common threads do you think Room has with other past selections?
One of the reviewers, Malcolm Jones in Newsweek, compared her work to her ability to get into the mind of a child to Mark Twain or William Faulkner. And so if in fact she's on that level, I would say this book will be around for a while. We have some other external evidence of that, and that is the number of prizes and recognition that it's received. Probably the most widely known is that it was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, which is one of the premier literary awards in the world. But it also won the 2010 Hughes and Hughes Irish Novel of the Year, the 2010 Rogers Writers Trust Fiction Prize, the 2011 Commonwealth Writers Prize for the Caribbean and Canadian region, Best Books of 2010 in Fiction from the Christian Science Monitor, and Best Books 2010, Top 10 Best Books 2010 Library Journal. So
that is a hearty list.
Pretty good resume for a book.
No. Michael, tell me, if somebody is, for the first time, wanting to engage with One Book, One Bloomington, and beyond, how can they get started? First, where can they get Room by Emma Donoghue? What bookstores? Is it available online for somebody's Kindle or iPad? And also, maybe list some bookstores that might have it available locally.
And don't forget the library.
And the library, yes. How could I forget?
We have a whole cart that I think they're probably listening to me there now and getting ready to move down as soon as I'm done.
Yeah, and the bookstores were alerted ahead of time that this would be the book selection, so I'm sure that all of the bookstores in town will have copies of the book. And I'm not sure about... I'm sure it's in the ebook, is it?
I'm sure it is too, but I failed to look to see if we had it in our vendor. I did see a couple of copies of the book on tape though. So for people who can't read, you know, can't see the print or don't or prefer the audio version, I know we have a couple of copies of that too.
Lots of ways to engage with it. So tell us a little bit about how we can, you know, not only start reading but then, you know, get together and begin talking about it as we plow through this very suspenseful, emotional book.
Well, one of the sources of information about events going on in the community is the webpage at the Monroe County Public Library. And people can get there. I'm sure Sarah can give us the address, but if you Google One Book, One Bloomington and Monroe County Public Library, it will take you right there.
And it's mcpl.info.
And so what sort of discussions do you anticipate this having?
Well, you know, we have a book discussion group at the library, Books Plus, and I believe this is the an upcoming selection. I didn't bring my list of programs, Michael. Do you know, is it the January selection or the February selection?
I believe it's in March.
It's in the March. It's in March, so you have plenty of time to read it and get ready for that. But we also know there are dozens of other book clubs in town that meet at churches and at the Y and at people's homes and workplaces and schools early in the morning. And they're always looking for a good book. So this would be a good one. I think it's a really meaty book. It's not, as Michael said, it's not happy exclusively, but it will take you through the range of human emotions, I think, in the course of a read, and that's a wonderful thing.
And one of the interesting things, a serendipitous happening, is that the YMCA had already selected this book for their February 14th, 1 o'clock p.m. discussion there, so that wasn't arranged by us, but it was already happened.
And what day is that?
That's February 14th.
Valentine's Day. Good book discussion.
And February 15th, the Wednesday following that, is the Ex Libris book discussion at Barnes & Noble. There are a lot of other book discussions that are upcoming, and as I mentioned, there is also a film series that will be at the Monroe County Public Library, and all of that information will be made available on the website.
Films pertaining to Room or...
The topic. The broader topic, I think.
Yes.
Which is?
Mother and child relationship, captivity.
For example, Wild Child by Truffaut is one of the offerings. Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan. Empire of the Sun, Christian Bale's film. And Nell, a 1994 film about a child raised in the remote backwoods of North Carolina with her mother. So those will all be free showings at the Monroe County Public Library Auditorium.
And what's the web address for people to look up that schedule?
They're films? Right on the, you can get there, you know, you can look at the events calendar, which is right on the homepage.
Excellent.
mcpl.info.
Excellent. And what about the for the MCPL's book club? You said room will be the book of discussion in March?
In March.
And how can people...
I don't have that date. I'm sorry, I'm ill-equipped. No,
that's okay.
We will also be publishing a bookmark, which we'll make available through bookstores and at the libraries that people can pick up, which will have a schedule of all the events, both the film series and the books.
Check our One Book, One Bloomington website or give us a call at the library, 349-3050, and we'll be happy to let you know.
Okay, great. Well, that about wraps it up. I've been joined here in the studio with Sarah Laughlin, the director of Monroe County Public Library, and Michael Simmons, who is the program specialist with the City of Bloomington. We've been talking about One Book, One Bloomington and Beyond, where it was announced the 2012 book selection is Room by Emma Donahue. Thank you both very much for joining us here on Interchange.
Our pleasure.
Great. Thank you very much to our assistant producer, Shane Young, for engineering tonight's program. Interchange is produced by Lewis Malone. The executive producer is Allison Bektesh. Our original theme music is by Jamil Ephraim. Stay tuned for Stardust with Tillman coming up next on WFHB. Your thoughts and ideas, as well as suggestions for Interchange topics, are welcomed at interchange@WFHB. For WFHB, I am Ryan Dawes. Thank you for joining us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.